This is Derek Bros with the Conscious Resistance Network. Recently, I had the chance to visit Tepoztlan, Morelos, Mexico, as I was visiting different communities who have been active in the area for decades. Specifically, I had the chance to visit one of the oldest intentional communities in Mexico and one of the oldest in the world, Huehuecayotl. I had the opportunity to talk with one of the original founding members of the community, Tonya, as she shared her experiences living within the community, traveling together, buying land, the different issues that have arose within community members over the decades, their organizational structure, their decision-making structure, and so much more. I really think what Tonya shared is invaluable advice and insight to those of us who are now currently seeking to establish intentional communities and eco-villages. I encourage everyone to listen closely to what Tonya shares about her experiences with Huehuecayotl.
So three Mexicans left Mexico in 68 after the big massacre in Tlatelolco Square, where a lot of young people and labor movement people were slaughtered by the government, and they went in search of themselves, like young people do, traveling the world and trying to find out what is it that keeps people together pacifically, peacefully. And that journey took them to more than 30 countries over the next 12 years. So in that time, they learned a lot of different things and shared with a lot of different people and developed theatrical skills to be able to use theater and music to be able to continue the journey. So in different countries, different people who felt affinity with the values, ecological values, and artistic, experimental values, joined in the group. And when I met them in 1978, I was living in the Redwoods, in the whole Back to the Land movement, without electricity and no running water, and living that way all through the 70s. They happened to be in that area in the 70s, and that's where I met them. So by the end of the 70s, we were people from 10 countries, and we were 15 grown-ups and 13 children, and decided to return to Mexico to see some of the families and go on tour. So we got small contracts with Bellas Artes, Fonapaz, Federación Electricidad, and got to see more than 15 states of Mexico from the inside. We spent our money going to visit the Lacandons and the Huichols and the Tarahumaras and the Yaquis and many other indigenous groups here, because that was always our focus. And at a certain point, we decided to put down roots. And instead of being a traveling, moving theater group, sending out a message of respect for diversity, we added some more people to the group and bought a small piece of land.
Yes. And so what year was that when the land purchase happened?
82. We were on the road for almost 2 years here in Mexico, living in our buses, which you saw pictures of right here.
Yeah.
And this is what we looked like.
So this would have been 72, you say?
Or 82.
82?
81, 82. That was the way we looked. This is just before buying the piece of land in Huehuecayotl. And this is how we lived before. We found out in the 80s that there actually were several showcases of ecological houses that had all the systems, and one project in particular that had integrated on a grassroots basis with humble campesinos in a village called San Pedro Muñozla in the northeastern part of Tlaxcala, seven integrated ecological systems. A priest by the name of Jesus Quiroz, who was also an anthropologist, a Jesuit, had persuaded one campesino to go for the loan that it would be necessary to build all these seven systems in his home. This particular village was lacking a lot of water. It was a desert atmosphere, and the people only had money to take the wife and six kids once a week to the public baths. So if any of you can imagine what that's like to work in the fields and only be able to bathe once a week, that was the situation of the people. They were very open to new ideas and new techniques. So Jesus Quiroz persuaded one campesino to go for it. He was the aval on the bank loan. And once the other farmers saw how they were able to bathe regularly, that they were capturing their water, they were saving their water, they were solar heating their water, they were able to have hot water between the hours of 10 and 4 in the afternoon, so they were able to clean the dishes faster and have a higher level of hygiene and have more time for their families. Mm-hmm. More villagers joined in, and they formed a credit union where they all borrowed monies with this particular priest signing the aval to be able to borrow those monies and pay it back within 5 years. Part of the deal was that they would teach other people how to do these techniques. So it was also like an underground school for training people in appropriate technology. From all over the world, people came to Mexico to learn that. And this was an application. You can see from these pictures that their pressure breaker was a simple item that you get anywhere in any hardware store, the solar heating device. They had capturing water, saving the water in a cistern, solar heating it, gray water systems, that means soapy water. They had what they call leach field systems that cleaned the soapy water. They had biodigesters under their stables and under the toilet, so that water was also being filtered to be able to recycle for fruit trees. And as you know, if you have a very healthy fruit tree that's being nourished with a lot of fertilizer, it will resist plagues and other kinds of diseases. So they also had the Cocina Lorena, which is a firewood-saving stove. It's a very special design. We don't have to go into that now, but it's a very interesting design that has become populated all over the world, Guatemala, Java, many places.
Are those practices still in place there at the community?
Yeah, however, I would say I went back. I was the first one to film there in 1981, and I went back in the 90s, about 20 years later, and because of several different elements that were affecting their community, such as the brain drain of all the young people going to the north to earn a living, and there wasn't that much in terms of young people around to maintain the systems, many of their systems were not functioning. And also they were very exhausted from the number of people who had come to visit. So they were glad to receive me because they knew me, but their systems were not being maintained with the beauty and the flourishing plant medicines and all kinds of successes that they had, the same way it had been 20 years before. And another element is that the priest had died, so he was no longer able to sign the bank loans. And so their project was not able to flourish in the same way, and they were just getting small government gigs.
So there's going to be people watching this who are definitely looking for community, of whatever that means to them, right? People looking to buy land, people looking to, you know, co-house and things like that. Super broad question, but I'm sure you can offer any number of answers. What would you say is just like a good piece of advice for somebody who's just starting that journey? You've been on this journey for a while, and they're just now, maybe they've been living a city life, urban life, and, you know, this is all kind of foreign. Any advice or thoughts to somebody in that position?
Research, investigate, do some personal work on yourself continually so that you know what you're dealing with in terms of the expectations that you have of other people and of what the community is going to bring to you and what you're going to give to the community. And explore, learn permaculture, learn traditional systems of regenerative farming. Check it out. There's no one way. There are people like the Proyecto San Isidro, Alejandra Caballero and Paco, who do not start off with the idea of intentional community. They start off by raising up the ecological consciousness of people already living in a village and working with the preschoolers and on up, doing projects that are related to all these subjects. And their concept is broad enough to include many villages. And that's also an eco-village, is a village that is transitioning to more natural systems. And some people feel like they're not apt for intentional living, where people decide things all together and they want to live in an area where there are other like-minded people, but they want to have their own space and come together when they want to come together on certain issues. Make an organic market, have a crafts fair, do intervention and working and learning from the local professors, who are the campesinos in every part of Mexico. And that's another way to do it. It's not necessary that people have to all live in one place.
You guys have also gone through, I think, a few different changes as far as decision-making. I know that's definitely an interesting aspect and something that people who are moving towards communities have to consider, obviously. What do you, just any thoughts on that? Like, why, you know, changes have happened with certain decision making, or maybe any thoughts on limitations of certain types that you've experienced?
Well, there's definitely a limitation on majority rule, because there's always a small group of people who just are not in line with the proposal, and whether they try to or not, it undermines the process. So I think majority rule also clips the other people's interest in what is it that you see in the minority that maybe they're not able to see, which in the other methods of decision making, like consensus or sociocracy, are valid things, where you actually pay attention to what is it that the people who are not in conformity with the proposal see that somehow places the whole group in danger in some way or at risk. So I would say definitely majority rule is not a good plan. And that's my opinion.
Sure.
I think consensus or consensus minus one, depending on the size of the group, is very useful for the beginning of communities. If it's practiced formally, where you only object or block when you see some risk that the rest of the people are not noticing. You only block maybe once or twice in your whole lifetime, according to real consensus. So under consensus, you also need to, everybody, learn facilitation of meetings so that you have a structure, not necessarily that you need big structure, you know, rigid structure, no, but you need some amount of structure so that you have a record of the decisions that have been taken, of the dateline for them, of what are options, and all of that is recorded. The decision-making is recorded. It's not just like, oh, we'll all raise our hand and be in favor of something. So I think there is a need for some kind of structure, whether it's consensus or whether it's sociocracy, which a lot of people are turning to, which is more based on committees and interlacing between those committees so that the information is circulating, is another good method. I know Diane is very committed to that should be the method for communities. But I think there's a place also for consensus, and maybe, according to Diane also, it's the beginning of a group works well with consensus. We had consensus for several decades, and then we became very, very diverse, and some people wanted to option to try sociocracy. And also sociocracy requires some studying. You need to study it in order to really learn how to practice it properly, because a lot of groups and communities have tried to do sociocracy, but they failed to do it according to the way it's really practiced and ran amok. So any method that you want to try needs to be thoroughly researched and implemented in the way that it's intended.
What do you say, you have any thoughts on the specifics? I think there's some clear overlap between things like consensus and sociocracy, and sometimes people might even have trouble distinguishing the two from each other. What would you say from your direct experience is the biggest difference?
I'm not an expert on sociocracy. I think basically we have dabbled in it. My impression is that under the formal understandings of consensus, you really pay attention to the people who want to block a proposal to find out what is it that they see that you don't see, and why, what is your reasoning, and there's time taken to explore that. I don't know how much space there is in sociography for that kind of exploration that is a serious listening to the people who disagree with the proposal. And maybe Diane needs to correct me on that one.
Well, thank you for that. So in line with talking about decision making, there's sometimes, this is like a personal question and one I think those watching will probably be interested in, is there's, it seems to be there's a lot of different conceptions of community, what that means, as you are well aware of. People who think that means living in the same neighborhood, living on land together, et cetera, et cetera. And for some people, community means they want to have a home that they visit a couple months a year, you know, or summer or winter home or whatever like that. But they perhaps contribute financially or other skills and things like that. What kind of experiences have you had with, like, for example, is it necessary to have different levels of voting rights or decision, you know, does everybody have the same decision-making abilities within the community with different levels of engagement? Is that something you've experienced?
When we were living under consensus and sociocracy, visitors or residents who were just living here for a period of time were welcome to assist, to be present at our meetings, to see what it's like. And even sometimes they might be able to offer an opinion. Of course, they could be in agreement. They were not allowed to block and didn't have voting presence in the meetings. But they were allowed to come unless it was a very sensitive issue. And I only know the decisions making that we lived. I did also live in another esoteric commune in California during the 70s, and the decision making was of a different form. But here, doing consensus decision making, I thought that it was very adequate for our needs for a very long time, and
Do you think it's necessary?
I think there are different categories of membership
that
can be made. We even developed one called associate membership, when somebody wanted to be associated but doesn't live here and they just want to support. And we always had equal status in decision making. Those of us who put our dime on this project, and those projects were always paid equally among everybody for improvements, for special considerations, special events that took place. Somebody's got a crisis and we take up a special benefit on their behalf. And we always did things on an equal level. There was no such thing as, we didn't have a system where you could work and earn your way into membership.
Mm-hmm.
But other communities do that. They do have a system like that. Our community was not that expensive to start because we lived in one-room houses that some people considered shacks. Even the tax collector considered it a shack and said, this doesn't have to pay taxes, this is a shack. So over time, our homes began to take shape and look a little different, obviously. But we always paid everything equally in every decision-making effort that we made. And there were special occasions where we had to pay extra for many things. And our meetings were the assembly to take decisions about that money. People also have their individual economies. Nobody is taking that away from them. You have your individual family economy, and we also have people of different economic levels in our community. So the decision-making is based on what are the communal needs. Got to improve the road, need to put in a water system, need to hire a worker, need to weatherproof the communal structure, need to do this, need to do that. Community relations with the villages around us, there's a million different subjects to take care of. And
would those all be voted on? Like, for example, fixing the road, like before everybody, if everybody's putting all the money in, would that be something the community votes on?
Yes, because we need a proposal. You need a proposal to say, we need to fix the road. It's, all the big heavy machinery that comes in here with water trucks and gas trucks and all of that, and we need periodically to do that. So somebody becomes the focalizer of that project and takes it on. And depending on the cost of that, what we worked out is that that person who's focalizing that project, whether it's putting all the telephone lines underground, or whether it's fixing the road, or whether it's building an addition, all of those things, we agreed to giving 10% to the person who's focalizing it, because it takes a lot of time to do that. It's not just, phoning up some people and getting some workers. It's about going and making sure that the people come and then it's done on time and that you have the codes necessary to do it properly. So different construction projects are taken on, and that's the percentage we figured out. It's very little, but actually it's okay. So now you're talking about the decision-making around. There are many things that get decided off the cuff.
Sure.
Because we don't have any obligation to live here or to be here. People have the full freedom to go and come as they please in the world, find and live out their mission in life.
So there's no commitment of time to be here per year or anything like that?
That's right. I wish we did, but we never did have that. And I think that enabled people to live their lives fully and develop themselves, whether it's sitting in a circle with the Mongolian shamans in the North Pole, or whether it's going down to Tierra del Fuego at the tip of South America in a busload of people for 13 years. All of those things were fulfilling things that different people did. And the fact of being a part of an eco-village didn't restrict them in that sense. It was difficult for those of us who were back taking care of making sure everything was functioning, and also that kind of freedom was a trade-off for everybody living a full and extensive life.
Hmm. What are your thoughts on, did you as a community take any specific steps? This might not apply to you guys so much since you seem to already had relationships, but for a lot of people, a big concern is vetting people, you know, getting to know the right people. And you have any thoughts on that, of steps or ideas to vet people?
There's no guarantee. People grow, people change, their interests change, their circumstances change. Don't have children, then you have children, then you make a school, then you're teenagers, then there's rebellion, then there's something else, then you get older, then they leave the nest. There's no guarantee with regard to the people that you start a community with. And also, you can find like-minded people if you start some kind of project where everybody has to come together and talk, share, live, party, whatever it is. Find out what your affinities are and have serious subjects in a circle in which you're doing talk and listen. You're not doing debate. You're not doing, I have a different opinion. You're doing just talk and listen, which is, I'm going to speak for 2 minutes on this subject, and then you pass the word to the next person. And you go around as many times as you want. So little by little, you get to know how people feel on different subjects and take the hard subjects. You know, where does my freedom end and my concern for community begin? Mm. And as you know, in your group, which was reduced from several hundred down to six after a number of different hoops that you jumped through, takes a while. So if you have a project that you can do together with other people and work shoulder to shoulder, not just making a communal garden and not just having parties, but actually have some kind of serious effort in which you have to talk and listen to each other. And I would say the dynamics of talk and listen, as well as other dynamics, which we can get into later if you want to get into that, would be a good starting point to find out who you're dealing with. It's like when you were the partner.
Mm-hmm.
You see where there's an affinity, and you keep seeing, you know, through different crises in life, how that person, what gate they come out of on this and that situation, and it gives you information about little by little building a kind of safety net within the relationship so that you can feel like you can surrender to it a little bit more. Hmm. It is a little bit like a group marriage without the sex, but
I think those are good ideas, though. Like you said, this is something we've talked about, doing a project together, having a group thing that we can all come see each other's work ethics and spend time. And, you know, some of the group we've got to do that with, but others, you know, are still living in other parts of the world right now. But that, I think those are two good ideas that people can start with. Talk and listen, I like that idea. And then, of course, doing a project together. You also mentioned a moment ago, I can't remember what phrase you used, but your efforts to get connected to the locals and to be integrated into the local community. That's definitely a big part of what we're focused on. And do you have any thoughts on, you know, what are...
You know, I have many thoughts on it.
You know, the pluses, yes, and minuses maybe of that?
If we're speaking about Mexico, this is not the U.S., Canada, or Europe. It's of primordial importance that you have good neighborly relations. And it does not mean that you just come and be paternalistic with your neighbors, saying, well, we're offering such and such course, and we're offering such and such. Because people might say, oh, you think we don't know anything? So having good relations, which means that you develop that over time, means, number one, speaking the language well enough that you can interchange wisdoms, and two, being willing to be of service in some way, whether it's coming with a big mojiganga to their festival and making puppet shows or whatever it is, but being of service in some way so that people can little by little begin to have some faith that you're going to be good neighbors. And it's also the case that for the number of years, many years, there were the powers that be in certain towns, I won't mention names, really were trying to pressure us to give bribes and all that kind of thing in order to sign our papers. And there's all kinds of things that do come up. But not in the sense of manipulating people to be favorable to you, but to have a genuine interest in the amazing things that people in villages know. And being able to trade, barter, whatever it is that you make, so that maybe you buy the eggs that they have, you know, farm-grown eggs, and maybe you make bread, or maybe you have a system that you can start doing an organic market, or whatever it is to understand that you are the visitors. Just because you buy a piece of land doesn't mean you're going to stay there. Mm-hmm. This is not a country where that is the high priority. But there are many things that go on in villages, and there's many ways that you can participate in a healthy way. And having an attitude of the importance of the villages that live there around you is really essential, because that is what your future depends on also. And so this interrelationship with your environment is something that motivates you to develop an interest if you don't have an interest. And I think that that's key.
Yeah. So you said you said primordial importance. Do you mean like, you know, obviously the cultural connection, and I agree with you as far as people need to be willing to learn as much as they might want to teach or share, right? But do you also feel that's for safety reasons, as far as integration?
You know, the issue of security, as you will see from David Holmgren's books about the descent of energy and the oil crisis and the different energy scenarios that we're all going to be facing, are an interesting factor, but it's just simple. We need each other. You're not alone here. And you're not on a piece of private land that is just going to be in some utopic village of its own. It has to be interrelated to the environment and to the other people. And just like any rainbow gathering, they come first a few months beforehand and relate to the people in the community and say, you know, this is what might happen and this is what we're prepared to do and what do you think, and find out what the feeling is among the people. They don't know you. You just look like a tribe of people who are kind of strange, and you need to give some sense of safety for the people who are around you, at the same time as also sometimes having firm boundaries.
All right, one more that I'll probe with for now, and then we can walk around, or you can stop answering questions. I'm just curious, like, if there's, like, has seniority sort of developed naturally as far as, like, those of you who've maybe been here since the beginning? Like, is there elders with more of a say than other community members, or is it all equal, as you said, like, where, as far as everybody's paying in, but is it decision-making is equal as well? If that made sense.
It's supposed to be. I think with any system, it can be It can be transformed. Depending on who's doing it. And there's no panacea. Whether it's consensus or consensus minus one or it's sociocracy, there's no panacea. I think it's healthier, the consensus system, which really gives voice to everybody, even the ones who don't talk very much, than other systems. And also, power can be distorted in any system. One always has to be vigilant to make sure the people who don't speak very much also have a voice and are researching the same things so that the power more or less can stay equally distributed among the people. There are some people who will never come to meetings, and other people may look upon them as not being very community-minded, even though they say, well, I trust you guys to design the things. But I found in my experience that the person in particular who is focused upon for being not very community-minded is the first one in every serious crisis to solve the crisis immediately. Whether it's a house burning down or a child falling off the mountain and breaking an arm or in a car crash or, you know, there's lots of emergencies that can come up in community living. And that particular person has distinguished themselves as right there solving the issue all the time. So I question this judgment that the other people have about who is community-minded and who isn't based on their behavior.